It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer-Kent. Spring's wetter-than-usual weather has kept Wisconsin farmers out of their fields. For example, only about 7% of the state's corn crop has been planted so far. We wanted to know how this might affect yields this season and what decisions Wisconsin farmers will face this year. Are you a farmer who hasn't had a chance to get out in the field yet? How's that affecting your operation? Are you worried that if you get too late a start, this could compromise your farm in general? Do you feel like it's too early to worry? Are you going to wait it out for the next week or two to see if there's a stretch of sunny, dry weather before you switch crops? Or have you already switched? And have you decided to abandon corn and move to soybeans? And what problems, if any, does that present for you? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Sean Connolly is a soybean and small grain specialist for UW-Madison. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, John.
And Joe Lauer is a corn agronomist at UW-Madison. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
Well, let's just start by looking at the latest crop progress report from the National Agricultural Statistics Service. We can see that only 7% of the state's corn crop has been planted. Joe, tell us about the weather that's kept farmers out of the fields.
Well, it's been one of those springs where it seems like every time it dries off enough to be able to get into the field, we get another rain shower that comes through. And we've had really statewide showers that have moved across, bands that have moved across that have put enough rain on the fields that we just can't even get in. And up until about last Friday, I think that was true. But over the weekend, we had some pretty good drying weather, and I think it's going to be a good week looking now. But there is some rain scheduled again. But every delay just delays the farmers more and more.
Well, in terms of the weather, how has this spring compared to what we feel is typical for this time of year?
Well, normally by May 13th, which is today, we have about 50% of the corn crop planted. As of last Monday, we had 7% planted. There was a little bit of planting going on, I saw, in northwestern Wisconsin this past week, so it's a little higher than 7%. But normally we'd be at 50% right now. And as we delay, if we could plant all of our corn on one day, that best date would be May 1st in the south and May 5th in the north. And as we are delayed now, yields go down, but you also have a double whammy going on of not only decreased yields, but also wetter corn in the fall of the year, which adds to the cost of producing corn. So we're at the point where it's really looking at we might need to consider some other crops for some of these acres. Again, I just encourage people right now to be patient about their fields and let Mother Nature dry them out a little bit, because you can have worse problems if you try to go in too quickly.
Well, Sean, let's talk about how this wet, snowy, cold weather that we've had prevents farmers from getting their crops in the ground.
Well, the biggest challenge that we've seen is, we've been trying to push farmers to get out and actually plant some soybeans ahead of their corn crop. We tend to start seeing yield loss after April 25th in the southern part of the state and around May 1st in the northern part of the state. So again, if one of the crop plantings is delayed, such as corn, then that's really going to push farmers back to not putting their soybeans in the field as well.
Yeah, for those who don't really have any direct knowledge of how crop farming works in Wisconsin, they might drive by someplace and they see these big four-wheel drive tractors. Is the problem that they can't physically get into the fields, or that just planting crops when it's this wet is a bad idea?
Well, I think it's a double-edged whammy, if you will, because the equipment has gotten so big that we need to have a little bit of a drier soil. But the other problem we have, and Joe alluded to this, is if you go in and try to establish a crop too early, basically what we call is mudding it in, we get sidewalk compaction issues. And if you establish a crop under that situation, you're going to be paying for that sin the entire growing season in terms of what that will do at the resulting end of the year in terms of crop yield.
And Joe, what do you think will be the impact here on the price of corn this season?
Well, that's a good question. We've got a lot of season left to go yet. Again, I just encourage patience right now for farmers as they try to get this crop established, make sure the field is fit and ready to go and in good condition. Sean mentioned the sidewall compaction. Another thing we can have is deep soil compaction, which, again, limits root growth. And but there's a lot of season that's left yet. The big thing right now is just to get the crop into the ground and get it growing. As far as the price of next year, you know, it really is influenced by a lot of things around the country, and things that'll influence it here. Our dairy industry relies on corn and corn silage a lot, again, the price is influenced more by factors outside of Wisconsin oftentimes than what's going on locally. And in a widespread drought, you know, the price could go up. But if it's a good year, you know, price can drop again. And it also has implications, you know, export implications and things. There's a lot of places that these crops grow in terms of their use. Corn's used a lot in ethanol. Soybeans used a lot domestically for biodiesel and other markets.
Sean, there's another crop progress report coming out later today. Do you expect to see much change in terms of the percentage of corn crops planted?
No, I would expect at max maybe 10%. Maybe we went up 3%, and that would just be a very conservative estimate. In terms of soybean, if you look at the crop report, they don't even list soybean yet, which is something we're trying to change. But I don't expect to see much of a tick at all just based on last week's weather.
Sean Connolly is a soybean and small grain specialist for UW-Madison. Joe Lauer is a corn agronomist at UW-Madison. We're talking about the effect of our cold, wet spring on farmers' ability to get their crops in the ground and what that might mean going forward. We invite you to join the conversation at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Wondering, farmers, what your plans are if things don't dry out fairly soon here. Sean, if some farmers decide it's a little too late for them to plant corn, soybean seems to be the popular options, but there could be some problems with that that have nothing to do with Wisconsin farmers. What crops should they switch to, or can they switch to?
Well, we tend to have them generally move to soybean because that historically have been the most economical crop. However, based on some of the tariff issues that we see out there right now, I'm getting texts from farmers that cash grain prices locally are approaching, if not below, $7. That makes it really challenging for a farmer to make that switch, just based on the cost of production, the rental, and what they've all invested in that crop. So farmers are under a lot of stress right now, and it's really a difficult time out in the countryside for growers to figure out what they're going to do if or when this switch happens.
And Joe, you alluded to things that are completely outside farmers' control as far as corn is concerned. How does Wisconsin compare right now with other states in the upper Midwest in terms of who's able to get out in the fields?
Well, in the last report, Iowa had 20% of the crop planted. Illinois had about 10% of their acres planted, and Indiana had about 2 or 3% of their acres planted. That was in the last report. So the whole Corn Belt is really kind of delayed at this point. I'm sure there was quite a few acres planted over the last few years, but those three states, the I states we call them, are really the dominant ones for corn acres. So they have made some progress, but not much. And as you go further east, it's even worse in terms of how many acres are really planted for corn.
So we're all in the same boat. The weather doesn't respect state boundaries, that's for sure. We're talking about what our wet spring means for Wisconsin's crop farmers. Sean Connolly is a soybean and small grains as a specialist for UW-Madison. Joe Lauer, corn agronomist at UW-Madison. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer-Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer-Kent. Our wet, cold spring in Wisconsin has meant that farmers are getting a late start on field work. We're finding out what that means for crop yields and the decisions Wisconsin farmers will need to make in the next very short period of time. Sean Connolly is a soybean and small grain specialist for UW-Madison. Joe Lauer is a corn agronomist at UW-Madison. We'd like to hear from farmers. How's the weather impacting your planting plans for this season? If you were planning on planting corn, how soon are you going to have to decide to go with soybeans or some other crop? You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Sean, you mentioned trade issues affecting farmers' decisions when it comes to deciding what to plant. How do our current trade tensions with China play into this?
It's having a significant role out there. When we look at the countryside and what the effect has been on the farmers' bottom line, most of the farmers in 2018 had forward contracted enough of the crop so that even though the prices were a little depressed, they had, you know, a higher price because it was forward contracted. Well, that opportunity didn't present itself over the last cycle. So when farmers are really looking at trying to both forward contract but also have some back for cash grain and just looking at the outlook, they're not very happy with what they see in terms of the bottom line. And again, as we keep delaying planting, we're losing yield. So it's going to be a double whammy with low prices and low yield.
The recent flooding in Nebraska meant that some farms down there may not get a crop in at all this year, and there was a lot of stored product that got ruined. How's that going to impact Wisconsin farming, if at all? Sean and maybe Joe, chime in.
So on the soybean side of things, it really won't impact us per se. Again, there was some price support went in and some insurance was able to cover some of that storage that was recently announced. But there's several million acres in Nebraska in terms of, I think a lot of that would be irrigated corn acres that were impacted. But that's obviously going to have effect for local farmers. And one of the challenges that we had is we had a big on-farm research program. And it's been pretty hard to identify farmers in Nebraska to do that when they're still underwater.
We have a caller joining us. Chris is with us from Kenosha. Chris, go ahead.
Morning. I just want to ask you guys, anybody really, if you think that geoengineering is having an impact on the delayed crop.
Yeah, this is Joe. I don't think so. Bioengineered crops are, That shouldn't really be any different than any other kind of conventional corn out there or any other crop that's there. One of the things that we have been able to do with bioengineered crops is move more acres towards no-till. And no-till practices oftentimes will delay planting a little bit. But really, bioengineered crops are in general, I think, helping farmers in many ways control pests better and also help with soil erosion and some of those things. So bioengineered crops really shouldn't have any impact on what the farmer's ability to plant this spring.
Joe, forecasts show that the weather pattern that we've been in should be breaking. We had some sunshine over the weekend. Should that offer farmers some hope that they will be able to get out into the fields next week?
Well, I think so. I think we just need some dry weather, and once that dry weather hits, farmers can plant corn acres, relatively quickly. I think the fastest we've ever done it, not to plant all 100% of the acres, but we can get about 75 to 80% of our acres in about 4 to 5 days if the weather breaks. So we just need a little bit of sun to dry things out.
And Sean, we've talked about corn and soybeans, but other crops are being affected in Wisconsin in terms of the weather. What are some of those?
So first of all, on the small grain side of things, there's a lot of winter wheat acres that are probably going to be removed from production. A couple of things. We had a lot of winter kill due to the icing and the cold weather that the stands have effectively died, as well as the late plantings because of the late fall we had. We had about 3 weeks in October where we couldn't turn a wheel and get the last year's crop out to get the winter wheat established. In addition to that, there's been a significant amount of alfalfa acres out there that have been lost due to winter kill. And I think we're going to see a challenge there is some of the dairies are going to start running short on forages, And that's going to push some of these acres to have some emergency forages planted in order to help feed those dairy cows. Because, frankly, if the crop farmers are doing just about as poorly as the dairy farmers are this year.
Joe, how much of an impact do you expect this season to have on farmers who don't have a lot of luck with corn or with soybeans this season? Are we going to see more small farms closing as a result?
Well, that's a good question. Certainly, there's a lot of pressure out there, as Sean has already alluded to. I don't know if it'll be due to the crop part of things. A lot of the farms that are under stress right now are really more on the dairy side. But as things get delayed, certainly that's going to put pressure on. Oftentimes, the operating loans that farmers have. Really only you can only have kind of one bad year before there's a lot of stress out there. And we've gone through now a couple of years where there's been some difficulty just in terms of bank loans and being able to pay off some of those operating loans. So if it's a couple of years in a row, many times we'd be able to weather that. But I think more recently that time frame's shortened quite a bit. And so, hopefully that won't happen. What we need to do is keep strong markets, keep being able to export as much as we can. One of the things about corn is we do have a good strong ethanol market in the country, and that helps grind a lot of the corn that's out there. But I sit on the corn board, and I know that the Wisconsin Corn Growers Association works very hard at developing foreign markets. And whenever you have these tariffs that kind of come in, a lot of those markets can be lost and destroyed. And it's going to take a while to get some of those markets probably established down the road. We just have to keep working hard at doing that. There is a strong growers association, not only in corn, but also in soybeans, that really work to develop some of these foreign markets. And we just need to keep going with that.
When we talk about the weather, we certainly in the last 10 years or so have seen a dramatic increase in the number of really extreme weather incidents. Lots more very heavy rain at the wrong times. Going forward, what can we do to kind of try to mitigate some of what we expect to see continue in terms of the weather when we talk about the cash crop industry in Wisconsin?
Well, I think one of the things that can be done is to keep residue on the soil as much as we can. We've had a lot of very intense rainstorms. Typically, a 100-year storm is when you have an inch of rain in an hour. And we've had a number of those over the last 10 years. And when you have that without any kind of cover on that soil, you can have a lot of potential for soil erosion. You can put cover on that soil by growing the crop, but also by leaving residue on the surface, as well as growing cover crops out there. And one of the troubles we have oftentimes, though, with cover crops is we don't have enough of a season after harvest to be able to get a lot of growth that goes on. So I've always been a real proponent of trying to keep no-till practices out there, where we keep a lot of residue as kind of armor over that soil that protects from a lot of these intense rainstorms that can occur.
And then just in general, Joe, what does the future look like for corn farming in Wisconsin?
Oh, it's very positive. If global warming occurs, well, a lot of that warm weather from Illinois will move to Wisconsin, and we can grow some of the higher yielding, longer season types of variety or hybrids that are out there. But I think in general, I'm very optimistic about corn and crop farming in Wisconsin. There's a lot of potential out there, and there's a lot of markets that a lot of opportunity for farmers.
Sean, we've got about 30 seconds left. What about soybeans? What's the future for soy in Wisconsin?
So since I've been at UW-Madison over the last 10 years, we've basically almost doubled our acres. So there's been a lot of potential for soybeans as we, again, work with the local commodity boards to look at new markets and new uses for these crops for farmers.
Sean, Joe, thank you so much for being with us on the morning show this morning. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sean Connolly is a soybean and small grains specialist for UW-Madison. Joe Lauer is a corn agronomist at UW-Madison. We really appreciate them coming in this morning on the morning show. Coming up next hour, we'll hear about a new WPR news series titled High Tolerance, about our state's rather complicated relationship with alcohol. WPR News Director Noah Ofshinsky joins us. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin is getting ready for summer, and for a lot of people, that may bring to mind things like brats and beer in the backyard or cracking open a cold one at the lake. For the first story in WPR's series, High Tolerance, Laurel White looks at why alcohol plays such an outsized role in many people's image of Wisconsin.
The sun is just starting to come up on Sunday morning. It's just before 6 a.m., about 40 degrees, and people are swaddled in sleeping bags in a brewery parking lot. Greg Francik is awake, sitting in a lawn chair.
But yeah, right now I think pretty much mostly everyone's sleeping. There's still a few people up that, like, you know, just up all night.
You can see air mattresses poking out of a few tents people have brought. Some people have also brought grills to the parking lot and are starting to make breakfast. Nick Courtney is one of them.
It's a thing to do. You show up, you have some fun, you drink some beers, you grill some meat.
The vibe is like camping meets music festival meets doorbuster line on Black Friday. So why are these people here?
You get something beer-related at the end.
There's a huge beer selection.
Good beer.
Being able to try different beers.
To share beers.
Really good beers.
Beer.
All the people in this line are here for just one thing. They're all waiting in line to buy tickets to a craft beer festival called Great Taste of the Midwest. The tickets go on sale in 6 hours. This is Wisconsin, and people are passionate about their beer. In fact, eating and drinking outside is Wisconsinites' second favorite recreational outdoor activity. A survey out this month from the State Department of Natural Resources ranked it just behind walking and running. Julia Sherman is the coordinator of the Alcohol Policy Project at the UW-Madison. She says alcohol is associated with things like summertime, sports, and college campuses just about everywhere. But she says Wisconsin is different.
I think that a lot of it comes from the fact that it's not specific occasions, it's almost every occasion.
The Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project estimates, based on federal statistics, the average Wisconsinite has 634 drinks each year. That's nearly 150 more than the national average. Jim Drager was a historic preservation officer for the state and is the author of Bottoms Up, a book that explores the history of bars and brewing in Wisconsin. He says there's a cultural consensus that Wisconsin is a place that imbibes freely and frequently.
People are told to think of Wisconsin that way because people constantly talk about it that way.
Drager says media plays a big part in perpetuating the stereotype of Wisconsin as a boozy state. That includes comedians like Lewis Black.
I love Wisconsin. I love coming here. I perform here a lot because I've discovered that you people apparently have some sort of federal grant for drinking.
Drager says Wisconsinites play into this sort of message.
People are more outwardly social about alcohol in Wisconsin than they are in other places.
Drager says examples of that include things like craft beer festivals or just drinking at bars. He says Wisconsin has, historically and today, more bars than the vast majority of other states. Julia Sherman agrees availability of alcohol plays a big role in shaping Wisconsin's identity.
We're, to my knowledge, the only state where you can have an alcohol, a beer, wine, and distilled spirits tasting at a gas station.
sometimes Wisconsinites poke fun at their own image as social drinkers. Sherman calls it a perverse pride.
But attitudes can change, and attitudes are going to have to change here in Wisconsin.
Sherman says the cultural association Wisconsinites sometimes embrace has a dark side and a high cost. Healthcare costs, law enforcement costs, and human costs when lives are lost. She says to avoid racking up more of those costs, Wisconsin communities need to embrace other parts of the state's identity. So she issues this gentle reminder, Wisconsin has a lot more to offer than just a cold beer. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now we're joined by WPR News Director Noah Ovshinsky here to talk with us about WPR's High Tolerance series. Noah, good morning.
It is good to be here. Thanks, John.
So let's start with this. What is the High Tolerance series?
This was a series that was born out of a retreat that we had with the newsroom late last year. We were brainstorming, and we wanted to take advantage of a year that did not have any major elections, and so we had a little bit of extra sort of journalism time on our hands. And we wanted to do a project that would utilize our entire newsroom, which, of course, is located around the state. And we wanted to add to the body of already existing reporting on a topic that is big here in Wisconsin. And alcohol was number one on that list.
Well, Wisconsin certainly, as Laurel's piece points out, certainly has a national reputation. Our cities show up really high in areas where there's lots of drinking involved. And the reason for doing this series now is, well, this is our opportunity because there aren't any other big news events happening in the state. What kinds of stories can we expect to hear as this series rolls out?
Well, as you know, John, in journalism, you know, outliers often make really good stories. And as we heard in Laurel's story, and as the audience will hear over the coming 2 weeks, Wisconsin is an outlier in many, many ways when it comes to alcohol. How we buy it, where we buy it, how much we drink of it, the cost here in the state. When you compare Wisconsin to other states with how we deal with alcohol in the criminal justice system, we are an outlier. And so there are various stories that we have taken on to look at that sort of outlier status. And I have to say, for us, John, one of the challenges was really finding the right tone for the series because, of course, and as the title suggests, this relationship is very complicated. And that tone, finding that right tone, has a lot to do with capturing both the good and the bad. And we wanted to be really nuanced with the storytelling with this series. And I think we've done that.
And of course, Wisconsin has a long history of the production of various types of alcohol. And so this has been part of our culture for, well, more than a century. And so are we going to hear about some of that history?
Absolutely. We're going to go back to Prohibition days to talk about how the current system of how we buy and purchase alcohol and how it's distributed around the state, how that has changed and how the role that alcohol plays at the state capitol and the spheres of influence that exist in the alcohol business, specifically the relationship between, you know, manufacturers, distributors and retailers, and how complicated the system is. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the role of alcohol in sort of our political culture, in the sense that our politicians often use alcohol as sort of an image to celebrate and to I guess show their sort of, you know, bona fides, I suppose, with Main Street, except, you know, here in Wisconsin, it's not necessarily something that's manufactured. Here in Wisconsin, it's typical for politicians to share a beer with their constituents. And so that's one of the things we'll be talking about as well.
And you mentioned that Wisconsin has news bureaus and reporters all across the state. As you look at the stories that the reporters are submitting and producing, are we seeing differences by region in terms of how our state deals with alcohol?
Right. I mean, obviously, in the area of treatment, for example, John, you know, finding good treatment for substance abuse, in this case, alcohol, is very difficult if you live in rural areas. There isn't a lot of good treatment options, especially those sort of inpatient residential facilities. There aren't many of them around Wisconsin, and certainly not in our rural areas. So we'll dig into the treatment options available to people. We also talk about, you know, the importance of breweries and wineries and how these businesses are becoming economic drivers in areas around rural Wisconsin, bringing much needed dollars into these smaller towns.
Yeah, we really have seen an explosion in craft beer, local wine production, and more recently in craft distilleries. We're going to look at that too, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a big part of this story. And when we talk about sort of the nuance and finding the sort of the right tone with this project, of course, there's devastating loss associated with alcohol here in the state, but it is also an economic driver, you know, especially in rural areas. And it also represents, you know, joy and celebration for many people in Wisconsin.
Will we be hearing about how Wisconsin became a state that is so identified and entwined with alcohol?
Yeah, I think so. I think the audience will hear it in many different ways, both on the political front, on the cultural front, how alcohol is treated differently in the criminal justice system here in Wisconsin. We'll talk about the people who's made their profession in alcohol and how that's changed their lives and how they've become, you know, well-known people in their industries by becoming very good, you know, brewers, distillers, winemakers, et cetera. So I think it's going to be a really interesting series that's going to touch on a lot of different parts of this very complicated topic.
And you mentioned earlier the series will run for 2 weeks. We started, obviously, this morning. How often will we be hearing these reports?
Yeah, roughly 2 stories a day, actually. So more than just around 2 dozen stories we produced for this series.
And it's taken several months for our reporters to gather all this information and so forth and get the finished products ready to go.
Yeah, the series was born in last December, and we've been in production more or less since then.
And for listeners who would like to get more information on the topic, or maybe they missed a report, where can they go to find that information?
I'm going to strongly encourage people to go to WPR.org/alcohol. That's where you're going to be able to read and listen to all of our stories associated with this series. And many of these stories will be a little bit more detailed than the radio stories. And like I say, this is a very nuanced series. So I think it would benefit from people visiting the websites and reading these larger stories that, unfortunately, we probably had to cut for the radio.
Yeah, well, radio is governed by time, and that's always our big obstacle. We've got about 30 seconds left here, Noah. What was the biggest surprise you got in terms of what you heard from your reporters here?
Yeah, I think among the biggest surprises was really how nuanced this was. You know, we talked to people who had very strong feelings about alcohol, both in the positive and the negative. But the one thing most people agree on is it is still something that hugely influences our state politically and culturally.
Noah, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time.
It was good to be here. Thanks, John.
Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's news director. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent on The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Michael Torkey is a composer who grew up in Milwaukee, and his music has been commissioned and performed by orchestras around the world. He's best known for his album Color Music, a suite of compositions inspired by his synesthesia, a condition where someone experiences different senses like sight and taste at the same time. Michael, welcome to The Morning Show.
Thank you for having me.
The world premiere of your piece, Music at Night, was this weekend to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Sheboygan Symphony Orchestra. Tell us about that piece.
Well, it was performed beautifully in Sheboygan on Saturday night. I learned that the Sheboygan Symphony is the oldest orchestra in continuing service in the state of Wisconsin, which is really something when you think that you have orchestras like the Milwaukee and the Madison Symphonies vying for that title. It is a piece of music for chorus and orchestra where I took Shakespeare's maybe best known text involving music and I set it. It's all about the music of the spheres, a concord of sounds. And the forces there, the choir, the Sheboygan Civic Choir and the symphony performed splendidly.
So you were born in Milwaukee and you grew up in Wauwatosa. How did you first get into music and composing?
I had a wonderful, somewhat unconventional piano teacher right when I turned five, where when I came to my lessons with the pieces all shifted around and improvised, she saw that as not recalcitrant but creative, and she would write one bar of music for me and leave the second bar blank, and then write the third and leave the fourth, and in a couple of weeks I was already writing music at that age, not even realizing that that was unusual. So she fostered my creativity. Her name was Audrey Wood, and a wonderful teacher. I was lucky to have someone like that get me going at such an early age.
Do you think your Midwestern roots have shaped your work?
I'm sure that it has. My dad always spoke as we were growing up in Wisconsin that beware of those people on the West Coast and the East Coast. They're not to be trusted. And I think that what he was alluding to is in Wisconsin, I have found we say what we mean. And elsewhere in the world, people use something called irony. They say what they don't mean. It took me a long time when I moved to New York to figure out what people meant.
I speak fluent irony myself, and I have a T-shirt to prove it. Michael Turkey is a composer who grew up in Milwaukee and learned about irony later. You have a sensory condition called synesthesia.
It's called synesthesia. That's
synesthesia.
The way you say it.
Oh, okay, yeah. Sorry.
That's all right.
Can't read my own copy. It's a horrible problem for an announcer to have. However, we mispronounced it. Can you explain what your experience of this is like?
Well, it's an involuntary confusing of the senses, so that when I hear music, I experience color without trying. Keys or pitches will bring about this. I have perfect pitch, so when I hear a piece of music, I know what key we're in. So Brahms' Second Symphony is in D major. To me, when that piece starts, there's like across my brain this just blue kind of field. It's hard to describe. It's almost like a dream state. And so the early on in my own writing, I experimented writing short pieces of music that never modulated. And the piece would be about that color, about the key that we were in from beginning to end.
A lot of artists, or maybe a bigger proportion of artists than the general population, seem to have this condition. How does this help you as a composer, or does it?
Yeah, I never thought it did. I mean, certainly having perfect pitch helps. That's a convenience. I don't think it's a sign of talent, like some people believe. I just think it's a convenience to know what key you're in without having to check it at the piano, or to help singers when you're coaching them. For me, the idea of those earlier color pieces was the architecture that I was dealing with, how the music was put together, and that I called the associated colors was a shorthand for what I was experiencing. What I found over the years is that people are fascinated and continue to be fascinated by synesthesia, and that has I welcome whatever way people are drawn into the world of music, which is so abstract.
You have an entire album called Color Music, right? and all the compositions are named after colors: bright blue music, purple, ecstatic orange, and ash. Let's hear some of your piece being performed by the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. We'll be right back. What did you want to communicate with this piece? What does it mean to you?
Yeah, that's from Green, if I'm not mistaken, and it's been a while. That piece, incidentally, was commissioned by the Robert Gard Foundation, which was based at the time in Spring Green, Wisconsin. And part of the commission was to write music that reflected rural Wisconsin, and then it would be played by orchestras around the state. This was in 1986. The Milwaukee Symphony premiered it. The Madison Symphony performed it. The Green Bay Symphony performed it. And to me, when I visited Spring Green, even in the name of the place, Green, I thought of the fertile farmland, verdant. It was a word that came to me, which means green, but also is with bounteous growth. And it's a kind of an optimistic feeling about the state and the color.
Of course, most people listening to your compositions aren't going to have a multi-sensory experience the way you do when you're creating it. So for most people, it's just about sound. Do you think that matters? Is that something you think about when you're writing?
Well, it doesn't matter, but I found that it's helpful to give something to hold on to for an audience. Again, when you pick up a novel, you can read what it's about. When you hear a piece of music, it's vibrations in the air, and people just don't know what to do with that. It makes us feel things directly, and that's why a lot of people think that music doesn't exist without words. Think of pop songs. People talk all about the words because we don't know how to talk about music. Vibrations in the air are so abstract. And I've found that if you can find some universal thing to hold on to, it's very helpful. People like the idea. Oh, that's green. And people will experience that along with you. I wrote a recent piano concerto called Three Manhattan Bridges. And the first the third movement is the Brooklyn Bridge, and at intermission people came up to me. My apartment is right near the Brooklyn Bridge. I could see it out my window, and this was really important for people to be invited into the sound world.
Well, and that is really one of the beauties of music in general, is it's potential to evoke something in the listener, maybe something the composer wasn't even aware of.
And that often happens, We're just the starting point to the listener's experience.
Well, a great starting point for listener experiences here. And I want to thank you, Michael Torkey, for joining us this morning and talking about your work. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, John.
Michael Torkey is a composer who grew up in Milwaukee, whose music has been commissioned and performed by orchestras around the world. He's best known for his album Color Music, a suite of compositions inspired by his synesthesia, a condition where someone experiences different senses like sight and taste at the same time. We're going to listen to a little bit more of his music as we close here this morning. I'm John Munson, in for Kate Archer Kent on The Morning Show.